Hello, I'm Jason, and this is episode 2 of Points and Focus's podcast. In this episode, I'm going to be talking about podcasting again and personal minimums in photography. So I started this whole podcasting idea pretty much on a lark and just using whatever equipment I had and trying to figure out where I wanted to and how I wanted to go from there. And as far as podcasting goes, I have to say, I actually rather find it to be an enjoyable pursuit, so to speak, that I can talk about things I think I find at least a little easier in a podcast than I can in writing an article sometimes. And so I think it's a valuable use of time and energy to some degree, but not an entire replacement for writing more detailed articles. So with that said, I actually, you know, find it amazing. In basically 3 recording sessions, I have changed my setup basically 3 times to improve what I'm doing, my system, my setup, how I'm doing things, and make things a little bit more streamlined. Like I said in the first podcast that I did, episode 0, the test, I'm using a Rode NTG2 shotgun mic hooked up to a Zoom H4N audio recorder, and that's still what I'm doing. It's basically, I switched out and tried my Tascam DR60D, and I like Tascam's interface better for when I'm like working on a camera or that kind of setup compared to the Zoom, but for sitting at a desk and recording, for some reason, the Zoom just seems to work better for me. The other problem with the Tascam is that it doesn't do a USB audio interface mode that like the Zoom does, which seriously limits my ability to just hook up the microphone or the recorder to a computer and record straight onto the computer. And that said, while I can hook up the H4N to a computer and record right onto the flat, I'm actually finding that I kind of prefer to record to an SD card on the H4N and then copy the file off the SD card to a computer. Part of that, I think, comes down to just the fact that if I'm recording to, like, say, my laptop, I have to have my laptop. Whereas if I'm recording to the H4N directly, I can, you know, go pretty much anywhere as long as I have the H4N in my mic. I don't anticipate necessarily having to do that a lot, but it's there if I need it. And then basically sitting at my desk, it's not actually, in some ways, it's actually easier to do that and just record to the H4N than it is to record using it as an interface to a computer. Part of that, I think, comes from, well, so my initial setup was I mic'd the H4N to MacBook Pro, record in GarageBand because I had a podcast equalization or a voice equalization filter that I really liked the sound of. It removed most of my annoyance with my own voice. And I think that's something, I mean, obviously, I think everybody's uncomfortable with listening to themselves in a recording that they just don't sound the way they perceive they sound, and that I had found a one filter that actually made me sound in the recording the way I kind of feel I sound to myself, at least. So it may not be the most accurate recording of my, or accurate representation of my voice as a recording of my voice, but it's the most accurate interpretation of my voice as to my ears. And I mean, much like photography, is perfect accuracy the goal, or is the impression of the artist the goal? And I'm kind of leaning towards the latter here. But anyway, I would record in GarageBand, apply this set of equalization, and my original intent was to do all the editing in GarageBand, and then I would basically only be dependent on having GarageBand in my, you know, I could take my laptop, I could go anywhere, I could edit. And I cannot wrap my head around GarageBand as an audio editor. I don't know why. I picked up Adobe Audition incredibly quickly when I first got a hold of it. And I found a great set of tutorials online around places, including, I'll put a link in the description. It's a podcast audio, or it's an audio recording tutorials on YouTube. And pretty much everything he does is in Audition. And I find that they were very useful for me to get a handle on Audition. However, I never adopted Adobe's Creative Cloud thing. I still have a huge problem with software as a service philosophically. I don't like the way that more and more things are moving to pay us continuously and pay us and pay us and pay us. And if you stop paying us, you don't have the software to use anymore. And so I'm still running Adobe Creative Suite 6 with Audition. And complicating things, my desktop is a Windows machine and my laptop is a Mac. And so I can't even easily or at all really install a copy of Audition CS6 on my Mac and run that there and do my editing that way. But so not kind of cutting the Mac out of the entire loop has sort of been the way to go for the moment. And I may find a better solution for editing in the Mac, or I may eventually break down and get Adobe Creative Cloud. And when I do that, potentially I will then have access to Audition on both the Mac and PC. At least that's how I understand their licensing. And I can, you know, edit everything in that way. Of course, on the same token, I'm not entirely sure how relevant it really is. I'm not working entirely from the field, so I'm not sure I'd want to even bother editing a podcast, even if I recorded one in the field, and not bring it home and edited it home and then upload it from there. So, like I said, I'm moving the workflow that I found that works the best for me so far is just record everything on the H4N and stick the SD card in my computer and download it and then mess with it. One of the things that I've discovered, though, about the H4N that I do not really... I've discovered this about all of the audio recorders that I... or both of the audio recorders that I have, and it's something I'm having a hard time finding a real good solution for on, professional or other audio recorders, is battery life and file write-out safety. One of the problems that I really do fault the H4N on having is that if you run out of battery power while you're recording, it's not smart enough to finalize the recording and write out the file information before dying. It'll go right up to the end, and when it gets to the end, it gets to the end, and then it's dead. And there are ways to recover from that if you want to put the time and effort into it, like making an image of the card and then opening it up in an audio editor and trying to extract the data, because the data is written to the card, or most of the data will be written to the card, but the extents and the file system information isn't. And that's what the computer needs to know to be able to let you open the file. And I think my DR60D works better or doesn't do that, but it's not, again, like I said, I'm not finding that to be the ideal interface for me for working on this kind of thing. But so knowing that the H4N is hard to recover from if it runs out of power, the battery situation is just really abysmal. I never really realized how abysmal the battery situation was, especially when you're running 48-volt phantom power to power a microphone. I started out, I had 3 bars on a full set of 2,000 milliamp hour Eneloops, and 30 minutes in recording a podcast, I had 1 bar remaining, and that's, I don't know how long that one bar is going to last, but that's, you know, kind of concerning to me in terms of, you know, knowing that if the battery goes out while I'm recording, it's going to be a huge chore to get the files back. And then even worse, if I'm recording in the field, because the file system doesn't know where the file ends, because that's the part that, the majority of the part that doesn't get written out and work correctly. If the file system doesn't know where the file ends, you can't record another file to the card because it doesn't know when to pick up or where to pick up or where it's safe to start writing the next file. And that's, you know, that kills your card. So basically, even if you have, you know, another set of batteries and you can pick up and re-record or whatever you need to do for the podcast or the recording, you need another card too, because you can't, you know, unless you're going to just throw, you're willing to throw everything away and re-record, because the card doesn't know where the file ends, basically. So I'm actually using the power adapter that came with the H4N because I don't trust the battery life to be long enough to allow me to get through more than basically a 30-minute podcast. I think that's kind of not the ideal situation. And I know the H4N Pro supposedly is going to have or has better battery life, and I'm pretty sure that my Tascam DR60D has better battery life. But again, like I said, it comes down to, I like the interface on the H4N for this. In this instance, the way I interact with it, I prefer that to the DR60D, and that's why I'm using it. I would add that, actually, it's kind of ironic, because I got the DR60D, because I didn't want, you know, a couple years ago, because I didn't actually like the H4N, and I wanted a nice, quiet, easy-to-turn dials to adjust the mic levels or the input levels, and that's something the DR60D had, and I liked the package and the pack feedback for the loop for the camera and all of that. And actually, when I'm recording on camera, that's sort of my go-to solution. It runs on 4 batteries, so it's got more power. It does the feedback into the camera, and that lets me have an audio track on the camera, so even if I'm not using the DR60D, I can record from XLR, you know, Phantom powered mics back into my camera's, the track that's right on the camera. And of course, that simplifies all of editing, in that I don't have to worry about trying to match up audio tracks to, you know, from an external recorder to the recorder in the camera. So, you know, like I said, that recorder has its advantages, but they're not the ones in this case that I'm looking for. And, you know, would I recommend the H4N? Well, I mean, now at this point, Zoom's got the H4N Pro, and the H4N Pro supposedly has a number of improvements, and it would be something that I wouldn't be adverse to trying out and to seeing if it was materially better than the H4N, especially in the area that I find most lacking battery life, and especially in the area that's most dangerous, running out of battery while you're recording. But that's not something I'm really interested in putting money on when I already have 2 perfectly functional audio recorders at hand. So that's what I've pretty much learned from 2 episodes of a podcast, is the easiest solution for me that I've found is to plug everything and record directly to an audio recorder, an external audio recorder. And getting into that habit with that workflow also means that when you're in the field, or if you're going somewhere or that kind of thing, you don't have to worry about computers, you don't have to worry about different setups. It's the same thing as what you're using at your desk, maybe with the only difference that you're running on batteries instead of a power adapter plugged into the wall. Of course, on the computer side, what you use to edit is going to very much be a matter of personal preference. I like Adobe Audition. I've used in the past the free software. I think it's Audacity. It seems to be reasonable, but I haven't used it in ages. GarageBand used to have a podcast editing mode, and they've gotten rid of it, or at least a podcast template, and they've gotten rid of it, and you can still record and do a podcast in GarageBand, but I personally find its ability to edit single tracks to remove, say, ums or compress gaps and silence to be incredibly more tedious and much more hard to use than Audacity or Audition. From what I've been able to see, and I mean, maybe I'm just doing something wrong, but you can't just select part of a waveform and delete it. You have to break the waveform in two places and then delete the section that you broke and then glue the two places that you broke, you know, from the two parts that you now have back together. And it's probably, you know, I guess if you're used to doing it or it's your only option, that would be reasonable. But I don't really consider it to be that good of a solution. For creating music, yeah, it's so great. Even as a multi-track editor, if stuff's, you know, reasonably consistent, it's pretty solid there. But for this task, I don't think it's the best program that I've ever or that I've seen. So with that said, that's sort of my update on the podcast situation, and I want to talk briefly about personal minimums in photography. I posted an article earlier this week on personal minimums, talking about basically understanding. I've spent a lot of time in the last couple of months, and I'm going to have another article, or I think I've written an article. I could be entirely wrong on that. Let me look. Yeah. I wrote an article a couple weeks ago, well, almost a month ago now, on testing and acclimating to a new camera. And I've spent a lot of time in the last couple of months working through the idea of really trying to acclimate to understand how your camera performs and what it's doing and what its capabilities are. And this has led me down a whole lot of paths in thinking about a whole scope of aspects of photography that I don't think are things that many people think about really with any significance or relevance or whatever. One of the realizations that I made when I was retesting my cameras to do noise reduction and sharpening settings was that the camera was a lot better than I thought it was. And I mean, I had some inkling of this back last May when I was in Alaska and I was shooting waterfalls at 10 o'clock at night at ISO 1250. And I was getting pictures that when I brought them home and I started messing with them in Lightroom, I was going, wow, this was a lot better than I thought it would be. But I didn't really quite follow how far I could push things. And for a long time, I've also had a required resolution calculator for printing, and where you can plug in the visual acuity of a viewer, where you can plug in the visual acuity of a viewer and how far away from your print they are, and it'll tell you how much resolution, roughly, that you need to have in your camera when you take a picture. And one of the sort of reoccurring themes that I noticed is that basically, as long as you can't get your nose right up close to the picture, as long as you stand or view the images from sort of a standard distance, which I'm going to say is roughly, you know, the diagonal of the image, but I mean, in a lot of cases, it could be farther or a little bit closer or something to that effect. But as long as you're viewing a picture from that distance and you're not trying to cater to the 99.5 percentile of people, you really only need like 8 or 10 megapixels. And the eye just can't resolve more detail than that. I mean, of course, having more detail than that is always helpful from the standard of it allows you to make bigger prints, or it allows you to let people get closer to your prints, or it helps make the pictures look better for people who have better visual acuity, and so on and so forth. But there's sort of physics in biology-induced minimums in just how much information you actually need to have and to deal with. And, I mean, there's other factors, too, like dynamic range is one of the big arguing points, I would say, in photography now, that, you know, people are constantly bickering over whose camera has more dynamic range or whose camera has less dynamic range. And, you know, that's great to a degree. And, you know, I'm not going to be the first person to say that you should have less or you should accept less dynamic range, because more dynamic range is more flexibility. That when push comes to shove, that's having, if you have a camera that can record 14 stops of dynamic range, it means you can go out and take a picture of a scene that has 14 stops of dynamic range. And then you can choose where to compress that to fit that into the, say, 8 stops or 10 stops of a printer or maybe a display or something like that. If your camera only does, say, this is kind of ridiculously low, but if your camera only does 4 stops of dynamic range, then you don't have a choice in sort of, I mean, you do in the sense that you can control the exposure, but you don't have a choice in the sense of how that's going to compress things. So you can't come back, go into, you know, your RAW editor and start tweaking the curves and stuff to make this look better as a print or better on a monitor or better, you know, whatever, because you can't expand the dynamic, you can't effectively expand the dynamic range. You can't add more information that wasn't captured. And on the same token, knowing sort of where the bottom end is, knowing, you know, if you're a photojournalist, knowing that, well, these pictures are going to be printed and printed on newsprint, and newsprint only has a dynamic range of about 4 stops and or 5 stops, and, you know, that informs your ability to have a minimum. And this is kind of where I'm going with this thought of personal minimums, in that knowing what you absolutely need, where you can't go any lower, what you can't live below, informs your ability to go out and take pictures in situations that maybe you wouldn't have taken pictures in before because you didn't think that they were good enough, or that your camera was capable of performing at the level that you thought you needed. And I mean, half of this, of course, is you have to know your camera and you have to know where your camera performs. But half of this is that you have to know where your won't cross lines are and where your I'm kind of not sure that this is going to be something I really want to associate my name with, or that I think this is pushing it. And I can't speak for everyone, but I suspect my experience with this probably mirrors a lot of people, a lot of photographers, that, you know, when I got my 5D, I took a bunch of test pictures, I went out and started using it, I started playing around with it in Lightroom, and it wasn't in a super directed, you know, I didn't at any point have a super directed test environment where I could look at how things were going to go. I never really put any thought into what the capabilities of my printer were or what the capabilities of my display mediums were. I only thought more, 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 shoot at the lowest possible ISO always. I mean, not that that's not good advice anyway, if you know, shoot at the lowest possible ISO that you can, and that'll let you get the shutter speed and the aperture you need for the picture. But I would go out, and in some of my early tests, I had shot at like 1600, 3200, 6400, and downloaded the pictures, and because I didn't have a well-tuned way to approach, or controlled way to approach, noise reduction and sharpening, I'd play with it for, you know, 35, 40, 50 minutes a picture to try and get something that I liked or that was clean or that looked good or whatever, and I was pretty much stabbing in the dark, and just I never was happy with the images. And a lot of cases from there, I would just kind of, well, you know, the image didn't come out, it doesn't look good, oh well. And I'd throw it on the back burner, or I'd reject it and delete it or something to that effect, and I wouldn't try and hang on to, you know, or I wouldn't try to print it, or I wouldn't try to do something with it. And I've found, interestingly, I mean, it was a complete shock to me that when I took these pictures that I print, you know, that I was shooting at ISO 1250 and 1600 in Alaska, and I printed one just on a lark to see what it would look like, and it was a really nice image. I mean, it was a completely serviceable, I mean, okay, it wasn't as nice as if it was shot at ISO 100, and I mean, that's always going to be the case, but it was a completely serviceable image. I stuck it up on my wall. I've looked at it pretty much, you know, daily since then, and I don't have any real complaints with it. I mean, and, you know, prior to doing that and doing this all camera, you know, all this camera testing, well, I shouldn't say testing, all this camera acclimation stuff, I never really understood where I was comfortable at going with the camera. And I think so long as photographers, if we're not clear with where we're willing to go or how low we're willing to go, and we're not clear on just what the capabilities of our cameras are, and we're not clear on just how we need to set up our software to get the most out of our cameras, or at least the most out of our cameras to our eyes, that we're leaving a lot potentially on the table, and not just in terms of quality in the pictures that we're taking, but also in pictures that we could be taking that we maybe aren't, because we're looking at them and going, you know, I'm just never going to be happy with it, and I don't see why I should click the shutter. That, so, yeah, personal minimums, camera testing, something I really, really think that is important. I mean, it's taught me an awful lot about what I'm willing to what my camera can do before I'm unwilling to accept the results, and what my camera can do, period. And I really strongly recommend that, you know, anybody, even if you've had a camera for a long time, unless you have several hundred thousand clicks through it, and then maybe even then, I really would recommend doing some controlled testing to look at the quality of the images and try and maximize the quality of the images in that your camera can take at ISOs above what you're normally used to using. It could be illuminating. So what do you know? There's another 30-minute podcast. So, you know, as I've said every time I've done these, until next time.